Okay, now we have questions for this evening. Let's see what they are. Dear Ajahn, who was the main teacher of Ajahn Chah? Are there any stories about him? Yeah, lots of teachers of Ajahn Chah, and one of those was Ajahn Mun. There's also a few of the other teachers, Lumpu Sao. And all these monks, in those days, you didn't just have one teacher. You had many teachers. So you go to the different monks, or no nuns around in those days, but go to different monks, learning a little bit from each one, because different monks would be stronger in different areas. So I remember Ajahn Sao, Ajahn Chah, used to tell about him that he was really, really tough. And so one of the things which was dangerous for monks, even more dangerous than tigers, was the water buffaloes. Because sometimes the water buffaloes would get sort of spooked when they saw monks. We don't know why. We always thought that maybe it's because that they confused the monk with a tiger, because, the brown robes. But sometimes that they would, they put their head up and start snorting. That meant they were scared. And sometimes they'd just run. And many monks get gored, by the water buffalo in the northeast of Thailand. But this monk, when any water buffalo started messing around, he would just kick it really hard. So everything, all the animals were afraid of Ajahn Sao. So he's one of these really tough guys. And so some of the other teachers, there's another teacher. He had, because it was in the tropics, he had an itch on his testicles. So instead of actually just getting normal medicine, he just got some chilies and put that on his testicles. And if you're a guy, just that burns. So these are really tough guys in those days. Other people, if they had any fevers, like another monk, he had some malaria or something, he'd just send one of these people in to get some, saline solution and a needle and just bung it in his arm himself. So really tough guys in those days. They didn't mess around. And so some of Ajahn Chah's teachers were tough like that, tough and stupid sometimes. So anyway, this is some of Ajahn Chah's early days. But in those days, there's one story which comes up, because there's many, many stories, obviously. One story, I remember him saying that all the monks, in the jungles, probably the same in Sri Lanka as well, all the forest monks in those days, they'd all get malaria. It was just, forest monk sickness. Because, there's hardly any mosquito nets, and you're in the jungle all the time, not much protection, and sooner or later you'll get malaria because there's lots of jungle animals. And so I remember him saying when he had malaria once, the last time he had malaria, he was just got a bit fed up with it. So that, he went into his deep meditation, and he said it was like going into the middle of a forest fire. And the fire, he was in the middle. This is how he saw it in his inside with his eyes closed. Outside was getting hotter and hotter and hotter, but he was right in the middle of it, where it was nice and cool. And it got hotter and hotter until it was almost unbearable, and he was in the middle, and then it exploded. And that was it. No more malaria after that time. So there's many, many stories of how the forest monks dealt with the problems, of living really, really close to nature without any medicine, in those days, how you could look after yourself with no meditation. That's how he got rid of his malaria, just by going right into the center of it. And he got hotter and hotter and hotter until it got so hot, it just, he said it exploded. I suppose medically he would say, the temperature got so hot that all of the bacteria or virus, whatever it was, just all died. And he was in the middle, so he survived. Next question. Rather than concentration, should samadhi be translated as meditation? Otherwise, there is no meditation as part of the Eightfold Path. Indeed, samadhi is not concentration. I keep telling this to people. That is not the way what the word means. For those of you who may know something of the history of the Buddhism in the West, the first books, especially the Theravadan books, were translated by a fellow called Rhys Davids. about, must be 140, 50 years ago now. And he was the one who translated the word sati as mindfulness. So that's where the word mindfulness entered the English language, from Professor Rhys Davids. And that was actually a brilliant translation. But he also put concentration for samadhi. And it doesn't mean concentration, it means stillness. So stillness is what is meant by samadhi. And for so many years, that when I started looking at this, you know, from experience, it didn't even feel like concentration, because as soon as you start concentrating, you never get any peace. It's just too much force. You can hold something with concentration for a while, but you can't sustain it. And so I started calling it stillness. I remember a couple of people used to come here a few years ago. They were Chinese, and they had studied Buddhism in the Chinese, and they came up and said, exactly correct, because in the Agamas, which is the Chinese version of the sutras, they always translate samadhi as stillness, never by concentration. It doesn't mean anything like concentration. And when you look at samadhi, the eighth factor of the Eightfold Path is stillness. It does actually change the whole ball game of meditation. In other words, concentration is obviously you need effort to get concentrated, but stillness, you can't get still by effort. The old story, I've done this every meditation retreat I do, holding the bottle of water perfectly still. Has it stopped moving yet? It's moving. So I concentrate. It actually moves more when you concentrate. Strange thing. I'm trying to hold it still, but it actually moves more. And this is how many people meditate. The water is your mind. You're trying to hold it still, and concentration doesn't work. The way to get water to be perfectly still, as you all know from the simile, is put it down. You put it down, you let it go, leave it alone and patient, and soon it becomes still all by itself. It's moving. But give it another couple of seconds, and it'll be perfectly still. And that's actually how we meditate. You try and hold your mind still, and it never gets still. You put it down, let it go, and it becomes still. It's pretty still. And that's what, you know, my simile. And Ajahn Chah, you just ask another story of Ajahn Chah. You may have all heard this one as well. He'd hold his hand up and start waving it. He said, this represents a leaf on a tree. It only moves because of the wind. If the wind stops, the leaf moves less and less until it becomes perfectly still. Because that's the nature of the leaf, to be still. It only moves because something outside of itself, the wind. He said, this is the mind. It only moves because something outside of itself, wanting, desire, craving, makes it move. So if you want the leaf to be still, you want your mind to be still, protect it. No wanting, letting go, and your mind moves less and less and less until it comes to its natural state of stillness. So you don't have to do anything except to protect yourself from doing things. A good simile is something which I read in the in-flight magazine of one airline, because I do travel around a lot, and you get bored traveling around the world in these big aircraft. So I was reading Air Flight magazine, and they said, in the future, they won't have pilots anymore because the computers are so good, and the reaction time of a computer is much faster than a pilot, that they have all of the aircraft totally automatic. But they will still have two beings in the cockpit. They will first of all have a dog, and they will have a guy. Two beings in the cockpit. And the fellow there is in the cockpit to feed the dog, and the dog is there to bite the man if he touches anything. And that's all they have in the cockpit. And that's the same with meditation. That's why I like that story. If you could put a dog inside your mind to bite you if you interfere with the process, to stop you doing things, that'd be wonderful. Because this is what where stillness comes from. Stillness comes from letting go. That's perfectly still now. No way could anybody hold that water, that bottle, so the water's that still. And that's what meditation is. Stillness is what happens when you allow your mind to settle down by not shaking it up and disturbing it with wanting and craving. And this is the whole process of meditation. The actual word for meditation, of course, it's a word which comes from the Christian tradition of meditation, which for them is mostly thinking, prayer. But we use that word for this whole process of the nearest word in Pali, I would say, would be bhavana, the development of the mind, citta bhavana. And this is the development of the mind into stillness. So that, you know, it does include things like mindfulness and stillness coming together, and that is the meditation. Diogen, you showed us the example of the pause between words for silent moment. However, I noticed that every time when you said a word, that word was still echoing in my mind. When the calm was fading off, the sound would come in. This went on and on. How to deal with this? How to have the silent moment when listening to somebody? It's one of the reasons when I mentioned that exercise is to get people at least to recognize what silence is. And I've noticed that there are three levels to every part of meditation. The first I call recognition, and then familiarity, and then at ease. It's the same when you first come to this retreat center. For those of you coming for the first time, you know, at first you don't know where the rooms are, you don't know where the kitchens is, you don't know where the toilets are. But after a while, you know, you get to know the place, you can recognize the surroundings. And then you get very familiar with it. Listen, if not already, in a couple of days, that's your room, and you know the pillow knows you, and you can, you know, snuggle up in your pillow at night time. It's just, you recognize you're familiar with it. It's like you own the place. And then after you get familiar, you become at ease with the place. You can really relax. You know where everything is. And that, so those three levels are there with, even when you go to a new job, you're going to recognize everybody, where the toilets, the photocopier is, and then soon you get familiar with everybody, then you can relax, become at ease with them. And that's the same with meditation as well. When it gets to, say, silence, you've got to recognize, what do we mean, you know, by silent awareness? And it's a crazy thing that some people have the idea that you cannot be silent, you have to be thinking. And for many people, that's basically an eye-opener for them, to know what silence is, that you can be aware without any thoughts going on in your head. And once you recognize that, you know, you can notice it many, many times during the day. You become familiar with it. And after you're familiar with the silence, you'll notice it lasts a longer and longer time. You relax with it. You're at ease with it. You don't tend to interfere with it. A similar metaphor is when I first got a bicycle as a kid. I was so afraid of falling off, I'd hold the handlebars until your knuckles went white. And you'd be so stiff in your body. And that's why I kept falling off. You know, because, you know, you have to, when you go around the curves, you know, you just have to go with the bike. You have to relax and let the bike take you around. But once I learned how to relax and let go, you could just ride really fast and just go around sharp corners without falling off because you relaxed on the bike. It's the same with silence. Sometimes we're so afraid of losing it, we keep losing it. And then after a while we have silence, we relax, we're at ease with it, and it lasts a long time. We never fall off. When you try to stay on the silence, it keeps disappearing. When I kept trying to stay on my bike, I kept falling off. When I relax, it was easy. When you relax with the silence, it lasts a long time. So in each of these stages of meditation, we have these three levels: recognition, familiarity, and ease. Even when it comes to the breath, it's incredible. People say, what am I supposed to watch doing breath meditation? They don't recognize what it is. That is one of the reasons why, for people who've never meditated before on the breath, is another very simple exercise. Now, you don't need to do it now because you've already been doing breath meditation long enough, it won't work for you. But people who've never done breath meditation before in their lives, I ask them to close their eyes, breathe in and out 3 times, and after the 3rd out breath, open your eyes. Just that simple instruction. And they all achieve that without any problem at all. And then I ask, how did you know that you were breathing in, you were breathing out? How did you know you completed 3 in-breaths or 3 out-breaths? How did you know that? And there's some sensation inside of you which tells you you're breathing in. There's a sensation which tells you you're breathing out. You don't watch at the tip of the nose or in your belly or anywhere, it becomes quite natural. And then I tell them, okay, now close your eyes again and watch 3,000 breaths. Which they can't do. But I say, just that is how you watch the breathing. That sensation which tells you you're breathing in, the sensation which tells you you're breathing out. Now you can recognize what that is, so you know how to do breath meditation. And again, with recognition, after a while you become quite familiar with that sensation. And after familiarity with it, you just relax with it, you don't interfere with it. You can last a long time that way. So this is why we have those 3 stages or levels: recognition, familiarity and ease. And that's especially with the question here about silence. Once you've recognized it, soon you become familiar, and after a while you get so at ease with the silence you just don't want to interfere with it. Silence is beautiful. And again, you ask when someone is talking to you, it's great when you're silent when someone's talking to you, because then you can really absorb all the information. I used to call that total listening. So when someone's talking to you, you're not thinking back, which means you're not obstructing all the information which is coming into your senses. And that means you understand much more of other people. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I have heard under right view looking after parents is important. I love my parents and wanted to look after them, but it is very hard to deal with them. Most of the time they want to control me what they like way. I have lived with them seeing their fightings and violence, and I become more stressful and myself got violent. Living away from them I feel more freedom and less stress. And now my heart wants to live away from them, but I'm not sure if I'm breaking the right view or not. Please advise me. What about the Buddha? He left his parents. If he didn't leave his parents, you know, we wouldn't have a Buddha, so it is okay. So yeah, you want to look after your parents and you want to love them, but there's an old saying, it's a Chinese saying, to love the tiger, but at a distance. Otherwise the tiger might bite you and eat you. So yeah, sometimes that parents are parents, they're not all sort of arahats, they've got their defilements as well, but that's one of the nice things for children. You know, sometimes we have these high ideals of our parents, which parents can't live up to. They're human beings, and they do fight. And sometimes children have got too high expectations of their parents. And as it was for me, I always remember my parents, they would fight and argue. But the nice part of the argument was when they made up. And because it was such a small house, a small apartment, which I grew up with, that they couldn't run away. And they couldn't hide their arguments from me. You could hear it, you could see it. And then, but I also remember that when they made up, I always saw that too. And what I learned from that is, in family life, arguments happen. You know, you can't avoid that. But you should never avoid making up also. And making up is almost worth the argument. Because it's a very beautiful part of family life. When the 2 people that get together argue, we shouldn't have said that. And they sort of kiss and make up in front of the children. And I learned so much from that. I learned that arguments are natural. Now, we'll always disagree with each other sooner or later. But how we deal with that? Yeah, you can argue. But then afterwards you come together and you make up. And that's a beautiful part of it. But it's also the case that, you know, it's probably an Asian wrote this. Because the Asian parents, you know, sometimes they love their children too much. They try to control them too much. And, you know, there comes a time when, you know, the love has to let them go. And they may not be doing things the traditional way. They may not be doing the things which, you know, you want them to do. But this is the 21st century, and you've got to sort of sometimes change. So sometimes many parents, they come from sort of very traditional, maybe Chinese or Sri Lankan or Thai way, and they come to places like Australia, and sometimes it's hard for them. I remember this one Sri Lankan lady over here. She lost her husband. So that whenever there was any problem, that, you know, she came to me for the fatherly advice for her, especially her girls. And when she came to me, her girls were about 18, and they wanted to go to nightclub. I said, "Oh, I can't let them go to nightclub. There's drugs, there's alcohol there." And I said, "Look, these are really two really good girls. You know, they want to go out with their friends. Trust them." And so I talked, you know, the mum into letting the two girls go to nightclub. And they're brilliant girls, and that's Tabitha's twins. Really, one's a doctor in London, I saw a couple of weeks ago. I forget what the other one is doing, but really good girls. Teacher, yeah. And really good, but they, you know, they wanted to go to nightclub, and for, you know, for a traditional Buddhist, nightclub, drugs, alcohol, no. And that would have, you know, the kids would have gone there anyway. But, you know, with the mum's permission, it's much better than going without the mum knowing. So sometimes we do need to give our children a bit of freedom and leeway and trust them. Yeah, it's a dangerous world out there, but trust them that, you know, they can learn how to cope with that world. So it is true. I mean, look at this. You know, they love your parents. The parents love you, but the kid doesn't like to live with you because it's too stressful. So please be kind to your kids. Give them a lot of freedom. There's a little simile which I had a long time ago. If you have a bird and you have it in the cage, if you always keep the cage door locked, one day you're going to leave the cage door open by chance and the bird's going to fly away and will never come back again. But if you have a bird in a cage and you do leave the cage door open, but it's a beautiful cage with nice food and nice place to rest, yeah, the bird will fly away, but always come back again. It's a beautiful cage. And that's with your kids. Now give them that freedom. Make it a very nice home. Give kindness and love. And also, you know, the kids might run away or fly away, but they'll always come back again because it's a nice place to come. But if you keep them in a cage, one day they're going to go and never come back. Is it right to keep silent when I know my mother or father and my sisters do wrong things like kill insects? Or wrong speech, because every time I try to tell them not to do that, I always end up with argument. But if I don't tell them, I feel guilty. Thank you with metta. Sometimes that you can't change people. You can make little suggestions to them. We're all owners of our karma. So, you know, we tell them, you know, it's maybe better not to kill insects. But tell them at the right time and the right place, not when they first come home from work, tired and stressed out. And so, whenever we are telling something to somebody, first of all, we must choose our time. So I always tell people, if you want to tell your mother and father that, you know, they shouldn't kill insects, take them out to dinner, to their favorite restaurant, and just really pamper them. And at the very end of the meal, when they get on to the last course, you can tell them anything. You've softened them up. And then you say, "And I don't think you should kill insects." "Oh, yes, I can see your point." And also, the Buddha said, "And if you're doing the same thing yourself, of course they're not going to listen to you." So if you're going to admonish somebody else, make sure that, you know, you're not doing those things. And sometimes that's the best way of teaching others. Do you be so kind? So if you find a little insect, you know, you sort of, you get on a nice piece of paper and you take it out in front of your mum and dad and your sisters. And sometimes they get very impressed that way. You know, for example, over in our monastery, there's always, this is in a forest, so there's always mice, you know, go into our kitchen. So what do we do with the mice in our kitchen? We do have Buddhist mouse traps, so they, you know, we catch them, but we don't kill them. And then once we've got them in the mouse traps, we just take them up the road to Carnot Prison Farm. Because we think, because they stole from the monks, it's appropriate we send them to jail. That seems to be karma. But we don't kill them. So, but when you tell people not to do things, of course they're not going to pay attention to you. Especially if it's your mother and father. There's one thing, when I first became a monk, I was so inspired being a monk. My father was already dead, but I kept on writing all these letters to my mother about the amazing truths of Buddhism and how amazing and wonderful meditation was. And then I got replies from my mother, and she never mentioned all the stuff about Buddhism. So once I wrote to her and said, "How much of this Buddhist stuff do you understand?" She wrote back, "Nothing." And I realized you just can't, as a son, you can't teach your parents. Even if you know, think I'm a great teacher, there's no way I could ever teach my mother anything about Buddhism. And it was quite so reassuring to read, you know, in some of the commentaries, that the wisest monk next to the Buddha was Sariputta. And throughout his whole life, he could not teach his mother anything about Buddhism. And even he was such a famous monk, he would go and visit his mother from time to time. And his mother would always say the same thing: "When are you going to get a proper job?" Even when he was in his 80s, still his mother would just really cajole him. And so you can't so teach mothers and fathers. You know, because you know, they gave birth to you. They looked after you when you were just tiny. And the psychology is such that there's no way you can do that. Oh, what's this nice little anecdote story I haven't told for a long time? There's one of the Thai ladies here. I better not say who she is. But you know, she was in a village in the northeast of Thailand. And she remembered her previous life. Now, from very early on in the village. And she knew that her son, from a previous life, had done very well, and now he was the headmaster of the school. And so when she got to about 5 or 6, she had to attend that school. And her memories were so clear that everyone in the village knew that, you know, that was the headmaster's old mother who died before. But when she went to school, this was in Thailand, the same as Sri Lanka, when the teacher, especially the headmaster, comes into the room, everyone has to stand up. But she refused to stand up. "I'm not standing up for my son. He has to stand up for me." And she was only about 5 or 6 years old. Okay, this was a headmaster. And this headmaster, he was a disciplinarian. If anyone made a mistake, you know, he had to go to his study to get the cane. But this guy, you can't cane your mother. So this little girl, she said she did anything she wanted at school. Didn't need to study, she could play around all day because no one could touch her, because the headmaster was her son from a previous life. She said she never learned very much, but she had a good time. So that's what happens in his finished life. So that, you know, how can sort of, you know, your son teach the mum, even if the mum's only 5 years of age? Anyway, what is the advantage? Oh, here you go. What is the advantage from an evolution point of view for nature to invent the jhanas and pass it to the next generations? Okay, evolution is a very materialistic philosophy. It works when we come to the bodies of human beings and other creatures, but it doesn't admit the evolution of what we call the human mind. And to think that just, you know, the body is all there is, imagine like a human mind evolving. And these bodies are like vehicles in which the driver just goes into the driver's seat. Just like cars have evolved over the last 120 years. If you see the old Model T Ford and see a modern car, they've evolved enormously. But the drivers, you know, we go into one car, into another car. And so the driver is like the mind, and the bodies of animals and human beings, that's the cars, the vehicles, which, you know, evolve. So there's a parallel evolution there of the human bodies, the animals, the vehicles, and also the evolution of the mind as well. And you know, part of the evolution of the mind is actually to develop these very still, peaceful states of mind. And that gives you a very, very advanced mind. Now, almost like the highest possible creature you could have, there is the mind in a jhana. And so we learn this little by little. So maybe in this life, I'm not quite sure how far you will get, but later on, after you die and you come back again, much of that sort of tendencies would actually be still with you, so you can get into a jhana again. And this is, I'm saying this because it's very weird that some people have a very easy time getting into a jhana. Why is that? It's because they've done it before. It's as if the mind just gets so far and it knows what's coming next and it just goes off and does it. And that's sometimes what happens, because you've done jhanas before. Your mind has evolved from previous lives. That's why I can do it. And the purpose is because, you know, it gives you enormous insights and wisdom. So it's looking at evolution in a different way, not just a materialistic way. And of course, you know that, for those of you who know my talks, this is one of my missions to try and come back to a more sort of mind-centered materialism. You know, the materialism of our modern age, this body, this brain is all there is, and the mind or consciousness is some epiphenomena of the brain. It's one of the reasons why we have a materialistic society, you know, which does not value just, you know, things like human interactions. We just have iPhones or stuff instead of actually talking to one another, where we, you know, think that sort of a relationship with another person, you know, it's just some chemical process, you know, when, you know, like love is just, you know, something which is an evolutionary sort of means of survival of the species. And there's something about that which never makes much sense to most people. It's actually demeaning some of these beautiful emotions, such as compassion. What evolutionary advantage is there for somebody working their butts off in the hospitals in West Africa treating Ebola? They're kidding themselves. There's no evolutionary advantage in that type of compassion, but it's very beautiful. And it's there, and it does grow with people. So sometimes the evolutionary argument is fine as far as it goes, but there's much more to life than trying to explain it away from evolution. Anyway, right intention, is goodwill part, or it will always be a problem? If you mean goodwill as kindness, then yes. Right intention, number two, the Eightfold Path, which is one of my favorite factors. It's Sammasankappa in Pali. There's three parts to that. One is intentions of letting go, nekama. Letting go of control, letting go of attainments, letting go of past and future, letting go of thoughts. Not trying to get something, but let go of other stuff. So, you know, when you're meditating, you can say you're meditating on the breath. You've got a choice. You can actually focus on the breath, or you can let go of everything else. Focusing on your breath doesn't work. Letting go of everything else does work, until the breath is the only thing left. Two different aspects, but one works, the other one doesn't, because one is right intention. The second right intention is intentions of kindness, avayapada. It's caring, compassion. That's right intention. So when you say goodwill, the idea of goodwill is kindness, then that is the second part of right intention. And the last one is gentleness, literally non-violence, ahimsaka sankappa. And many people know the word ahimsa from the teachings of Gandhi, of non-violence. But still, that sometimes you go into some of these Zen retreats and this monk comes behind you and hits you on the back. Or you have some of these other retreats where you have to go through pain and get up really in the morning. And that's not right intention, that's not gentleness, that's fierceness. So right intention, which is part of, an essential part of Buddhism, to be applied to meditation as well, is intentions of letting go, of kindness, of gentleness. Sometimes letting go is hard for people to understand, so I call it making peace. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. You see them on some people's t-shirts. I saw it on the back of a t-shirt this morning. And it's, you know, right intention. Second factor of the Eightfold Path is how to meditate. Just make peace with your mind. Let it go. Be kind. Be gentle. That's an important part of meditation. And that is, now if you mean goodwill as kindness, yeah, that's part of meditation. In one of your talks, you said that there is an attraction or a pleasure in pain, grief, anger, etc., as well as in thinking. Can you please elaborate? Thank you. This is again a teaching of the Buddha, to notice in any state there is a pleasure, they call it asada, it literally means a beautiful taste, and there is danger, and there is an escape. He said otherwise that people would never get angry. They would never even get grief if there wasn't some pleasurable part of it. It's a great insight of the Buddha. And sometimes, how can you get sort of pleasure in grief? Or in anger or in fear? If you want to know why people get pleasure in fear, just go to one of the theme parks where they have these death drops. Or they have these machines which put you upside down. And people pay good money to scare the shit out of themselves. What do they do that for? It's crazy stuff, because there's a pleasure in fear. There's a pleasure in anger too. You know, sometimes you see people getting angry and you can see the energy comes up and they get alive. And that pleasure is the danger in it. And it's also, well, other things. Even in sleepiness is a pleasure there, because you don't have to deal with problems. You're in a dull state. So there's always a pleasure in these things, but the danger in them is usually greater. So you see the danger in things like fear and grief and anger and pain even. There was one little story I remember. There was this long-haired guru called Ram Dass some time ago, and he was one of these like hippie teachers. And he wrote this little anecdote. He was with one of his disciples. He was a guru disciple. His disciple's father was really sick in hospital, in pain. And she thought, maybe my guru might be able to help my dad. And so the dad was one of these rednecks in the United States. And when he saw this long-haired hippie come into his room, you know, he wasn't impressed. And when his daughter said, this is my guru, yeah, okay, but you know, you can come in here, but don't say anything. So he couldn't say anything. So, you know, he decided just to give the father a foot massage. And as this guru was massaging this very sick man's feet, all his pain went away. And as soon as the pain went away, the man said, get away from my feet, you freak! He'd rather have the pain and keep his understanding than have his understanding challenged and be free from pain. It's a strange thing that sometimes, no, don't take my pain away. I can't understand what you're doing. People get attached to pain. It's credible, but it's true. So there's a certain pleasure in that. There are the masochists who find the pleasure in pain. They're alive. They're whatever's going on in them. And so that's the pleasure in these things. If there wasn't a pleasure, then people would sort of get rid of it pretty quickly. So once you understand what the attraction is, why you get attached to these states, then you can see the cause. But you realize it's a danger. All this thinking, it just drives you, gets you very tired, especially. Because thinking just wastes so much energy, so much human energy gets wasted in thinking. And if we could just stop that, which we're going to do during this retreat, the thinking will get less and less and less. And as it gets less and less and less, your brain becomes more energized. You can see more, you can smell more, the food tastes more delicious, everything starts to brighten up. You get awake and you realize this thinking has just stopped you having all this energy. It has weakened the mindfulness. And you get so much happiness when you're silent. And so you see the pleasure in it. And that's when you see the pleasure in these things, it's much better not to think. You're much wiser when you don't think. And all this thinking, it promises you so much wisdom, thinking. Has it really delivered? So try the other opposite. Try being still, being silent. you find you're far wiser. You get all your insights from silence, not from thinking. So when you've seen the attraction and you've seen the problem in it, then it's a no-brainer. You let it go. It's a waste of time. Could you tell us about the names of some monasteries with good traditions and teachings in Thailand? Thank you. I haven't been to Thailand that much over the last few years, you know, because of the bhikkhuni ordination. And even then, I didn't go to too many monasteries, so I'm not really up to date with what's going on over there. But I did go to see Ajahn Gunha the last time I was over in Thailand, and he's a really good monk. He's the monk who patted the snake. And I mentioned that to somebody the other day, and they've forgotten the story. I think it was over in Bodhinyana Monastery. And this is, everybody saw this, he was meditating in the jungle with a number of monks. And king cobra came up to them, and everybody heard it because it's a huge animal. I've only ever seen one in the wild, and honestly, it was about 10 meters long. And that's long. That's half. This is 16 meters long. Yeah, probably, you know, because what happened, I couldn't see its head, couldn't see its tail, but saw it across the path. And amazing, not scared, because these are basically magical animals. They've got power or whatever. And counted how many path widths it was until I got the tail, and I couldn't believe just how long this was. So it would have been about 10 meters long. Huge snake. But anyway, this snake sort of came up to this monk, Ajahn Gunha, the head monk, and sort of, like most snakes, you know, they sort of lift up its head, opened up its hood, it's a king cobra, right in front of the monk's nose. And you learn pretty quickly by seeing these wild animals, it's a waste of time running. Because those animals, those snakes especially, they can run so fast. Now, you can't outrun them, they'll catch you. So this monk, he couldn't run. Now, what did he do? So he lifted up his hand and patted the cobra on the head, saying in Thai, "Thank you for visiting me," and kept on patting the cobra on the head. And the cobra loved every minute of it, because it's quite rare these days to be able to get a pat on your head from a human being if you're a dangerous snake. And this, all the monks saw this, and he was patting it on the head. And after he finished patting it on the head, you know, for maybe about 5 minutes, the cobra drew in its hood, put its head down, and went to go see another monk. Lifted up its head, opened up its hood, and that monk said, "No, go back to him. I'm not doing this. And I mentioned that story because, what was it, a Friday morning, I went over to our local council offices, you know, to try and get building permission. We're building a nun's cottage so that in the future you can have your own little cottage, you know, when you come on retreats, and 4 rooms or more nuns can come on meditation retreats. So I went there and I was talking about the old mayor of the Shire, who used to be one of our neighbours. And when we first started Bodhinyana Monastery, he came for an official visit. This is the mayor. And he was an Australian farmer. And like most Australian farmers, he had a very big belly, much bigger than mine, if you can believe that. And had this enormous, like, Australian belly. And this monk, Ajahn Gunha, was visiting us. And, you know, the mayor came, and Ajahn Gunha went straight to him and put his hand on his belly and started rubbing the mayor's belly. And I thought, oh God, you can't do that in Australia. You know, this is the West, you do that. And I thought, we'll never get any permission to do anything. No building permission, no planning permission, that's it. The council's going to hate us because we're weird. We rub the mayor's belly. But I can never forget the mayor's face. He just melted, has this incredible, beautiful smile on his face. And he was like gurgling, like a little baby. He loved every minute of it. And from that time on, he became our real good friend. And we had no trouble getting permission for anything, thanks to Ajahn Gunha rubbing this guy's tummy. It wasn't a tummy rub, it was just he had so much kindness and so much loving kindness that he could do anything to pat a snake on the head, rub a mare's belly. You know, he could sort of probably rub Tony Abbott's head on his dot, and Tony Abbott would just gurgle as well. He was just an incredible fellow. So he's still alive. He's a nice monk to go and visit. And he's got a few Western monks there at all?
Not that I have seen.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah. So it's a nice monastery to go to. And that's 2 hours from Bangkok? Yeah, 2 hours from Bangkok?
2 to 3 hours.
Yeah, okay, yeah. It's a nice monastery. How does seeing non-self lead to stream entry? It's actually the essential insight for stream winning. Once you realize there's no one in here, oh, what a relief. I don't have to worry about anything anymore. Ajahn Bum doesn't exist. Oh, what freedom. It's a lot of responsibility having a person inside you have to train and look after and improve. All your life is improving yourself. Imagine realizing there's nobody in here, nothing to improve anymore. Woohoo! Now I can relax and enjoy myself. Now I can be free of craving. So seeing oneself is an essential part, which means one of the things you do when there's nobody in here, just why are you so attached to the past? It wasn't you. So why are you worried about what happened? What are you afraid of the future for? There's no one there. So you can let go of the past and future. So you don't have so much stress. And one of the other things which happens when there's no self, it's obvious you forgive. It's just cause and effect. It's not Ananda made all the mistakes. It's not Ping Pong made the mistakes. And it's not Elaine did a wrong thing. There's no one here. So who can you blame? So you just forgive. So that's one of the reasons why. Because you can let go of the past, and the forgiveness becomes so easy, especially forgiving yourself, that guilt vanishes. And there's no possibility of ever going into a lower realm. You won't send yourself there anymore. Ridiculous to punish yourself. So that's one of the things with non-self. You see that there's nobody here. And because there's nobody here, there's nothing could be destroyed. It just vanishes. There's one of the great stories of enlightenment about what it is. It's the Agi Wachagota Sutta. It was, it's based on that anyway. When the Buddha said that, you know, when a flame is extinguished. Or rather, Wachagota said, where does the flame go when it's extinguished? Does the flame go to heaven if it's been a good flame? Or does it go to the hell realms if it's been bad flames? Does it go to the east, west, north, south? It doesn't go anywhere, it's just extinguished, that's all. Because what is a flame anyway? If it's like a candle, the flame is just a combination of three things. The wick, the wax, and the heat. When those three things come together, a wick, wax and heat, you get the flame. And if one of those causes disappears, the wax is all used up, the wick is burnt out, or something blows the heat away, then the flame stops. It doesn't go anywhere. It's just all it was three causes coming together, and one of those causes stops, there's no more flame. That's what it said about this thing you call you. It's just a bunch of causes, that's all. That's seeing non-self, just five candles. Well, one of those candles stops, everything stops. The cause stops, nothing left. But where do we go? The same place where flames go once they're extinguished. They don't go anywhere. And the word for a flame extinguishing is Nibbana. That's where they got their word from. So I often say, in the time of the Buddha, even kids would know what Nibbana meant. Just they just say, "Oh, the flame's Nibbana. We've got to light it up again." So there was a word in common usage. So that's what happens. Just when the flame is extinguished, when you are gone. Where do you go? The same place where flames go. In other words, nowhere. There we go. Abhidharma and jhanas and sutta jhanas. Jhanas with nimitta, jhanas without nimitta. Jhanas with five physical senses gone, jhanas without five physical senses gone. Jhanas difficult to attain, jhanas easy to attain. Various teachers blah, 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 have different views on jhanas. Like everything else, jhanas may be experienced differently according to everybody's karma. Now, first of all, the Abhidharma was not taught by the Buddha. It's very clear. For those people who their beliefs are more important than the facts, then you will always bend the truth to fit your beliefs. But the facts of the matter are, the evidence is quite convincing. The Buddha never taught the Abhidharma. When the monks met after the Buddha passed away, they met in the Satapana cave. This is an old tradition. 500 arahats met and started off with Venerable Upali. He chanted the Vinaya. And then Ananda, he recited the Pancha Nikaya, the five Nikayas. We have those these days. Digha Nikaya, Majjhima Nikaya, Sanyutta Nikaya, Anguttara Nikaya, and Kudaka Nikaya. No even mention of any Abhidhamma. Not at all. And now these days we have people who can look at the nature of language and vocabulary in the same way that if you looked at Shakespeare and compared it to Harry Potter, you would realize that Harry Potter was not written in the 16th century. It could not have been. The language is totally different. And the same way you look at the language of the Abhidharma and it's about 200 years later than the time of the Buddha. It cannot be there. And you look at there's not just the Pali Abhidharma, every tradition, every sect has its own Abhidharma. It's all different. Suttas are the same, pretty much. Vinaya is the same. Abhidharma is totally different, which shows that it came much later. So, now the Abhidharma was not taught by the Buddha. The last time I was in Sri Lanka, you know, I told that, and the monks who were with me said, oh, well done, Ajahn Brahma, you can say that, but we try saying that, and you get all of this feedback from over. You can't say that, that's bad. But everybody knows it's true that the Abhidharma was not taught by the Buddha. Jhanas with nimitta, without nimitta, blah, 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 blah. One thing with the jhanas you should know, this is straight from the suttas. The suttas are the best source because that was taught by the Buddha. When there are jhanas, you know it's a jhana, number one, that you can't think. You can't give things names. You can't verbalize. So if ever you're in a nice meditation state and you ask, is this a jhana? It can't be. If you can think like that, your mind is just too coarse. Number two, you can't hear or see or smell, taste, touch within a jhana. You can't hear anything. The five senses are stopped. That's the jhana. And number three, one of the biggest signs, you have what we call the afterglow. After you've got into it, this is, you call it Uttriya Manusadham. These are superior states. Monks aren't supposed to tell people they've got these things. They're supposed to keep it quiet, just like being enlightened. It's way up there with enlightenment and psychic powers. So it's a great state. So if you've achieved a jhana and you come up to me afterwards and say, Ajahn Brahma, I just achieved a jhana. No way. But if you come up afterwards and say, Ajahn Brahma, oh, whew. Oh, something happened. Oh, it was amazing. The nearest you can actually say, if you've had like a son or a daughter, especially a daughter who's just fallen in love for the first time, and they come to you and say, Mummy, I met this incredible guy. I'm in love. Now, something like that, this is an emotional powerhouse of experience, the jhanas. So you can't just say, oh yeah, just had a jhana. So that afterglow is maybe one of the most important of the qualities of a jhana. But one of the... So yeah, go on.
Can I go back to Abhidharma?
Yeah.
Because in Thailand you believe that the Abhidharma was taught by the Buddha in the Dharma Dinsa, and the Buddha said and tall, venerable Sariputta, and that's what's called Abhidhamma. Could you please tell me where this story comes?
Yes, that story of the Buddha going up to Tawatingsa heaven to teach his mother, who actually lived in the Tusita realm. He went to the wrong place and spent one range retreat teaching this. Now, you also know, this is commentaries, that in the Tawatingsa realm, one day in the Tawatingsa realm is equal to 100 years of human life. So 3 months, I worked this out, is about, I think, how was it, about 36 minutes or something. So the Buddha had 36 minutes to teach the whole Abhidhamma. If you try and recite even just a couple of pages of it, it's much longer than 36 minutes. It's impossible, rationally. Now that was in the commentary. And I think it was Ajahn Sujata, or somebody made this very nice comment. If the Buddha was going to teach the Abhidhamma, he would not be teaching it to devas, he'd be teaching it to human beings, first of all. People would really appreciate it much more. There's no record of him doing that at all. So the whole thing is so sus, you know, suspicious, that anybody with a brain would actually say, sorry, but it doesn't make any sense. There's no mention of that story anywhere in the sutras. It's in the commentaries, not in the sutras. So you'd think in the sutras it would be recited, and it would be well known. And the Abhidhamma, as I said, is different, very different from the Sarvastivada, Abhidhamma, Dhammagupta, Abhidhamma. They're incredibly different. And that's actually, people argued about Abhidhammas. That's what created divisions in the Sangha in the early days. And if it really came from the Buddha, there would be no arguments at all. So, and the Abhidhamma actually causes a lot of problems when it comes to it's the Abhidhamma who says there is no intermediate state after you die. As soon as you die, you get reborn. And people have seen ghosts. You know, they've spoken to ghosts. And they've heard ghosts. And, you know, this is reality which people have, which is not allowed according to the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma said, no, that didn't happen. But it did happen. It's like in Thailand when they say there's no bhikkhunis, when they're right there in front of you. So there's many mistakes in the Abhidhamma. So no need to worry about the Abhidhamma, just the sutras is enough. And jhana is jhana, there's not one jhana, another jhana, there's only jhanas. Anyway, here we go. During sitting meditation, when the body is quite relaxed, the head tends to tilt up or sometimes tilt down with the upper part of the body. If I allow it, I feel comfort as the air flows better, but should I allow it or adjust my posture sitting upright and face the front? Will the previous posture lead to deep meditation since it is comfortable? Exactly. It's let the body adjust itself. So sometimes in meditation you experience your body just doing weird things. It may be just, you know, it's just moving this way and that way, maybe even twisting around. If the body wants to do it, the body is much wiser than you are. Let it do it. And you usually do feel comfortable. So don't you think that you have to have a perfect posture to get into a deep meditation. I always thought that the postures were important. All these different traditions told you to do it the Tibetan way. You know, sit full lotus, sit half lotus, sit Burmese way, which is the best, and it doesn't matter. Because there was one time when I had typhus fever in a Ubon hospital. I won't go the whole story, but it was really unpleasant. And one day I was, after about 3 or 4 weeks, you know, in the hospital with typhus fever, and just no energy at all, I'm really weak, and just really aching, in pain, depressed, and thinking, I'm just going to meditate. You know, I'm a monk, let's just meditate. And I got into a nice, really deep meditation. You couldn't feel your body. And that was such bliss. You know, if you have a... at an ordinary time, it's bliss. And when you're escaping from typhus fever, that's amazing. But one thing I noticed when I came out of the meditation, I checked my posture. Never seen that posture in any book. Because you're in bed with a leg this way, a leg that way, arms all over the place. And you just go into great meditation. And I proved to myself, anyway, you don't need to be in this posture or that posture. Let the body decide. It knows best. And then you can just, so your body tilted, whatever it did, you felt comfortable, great. Carry on like that. Your body knows better than you do. Dear Ajahn, what do you think of lucid dreaming? Can it help with your meditation practice? Lucid dreaming means you're sleeping too much. Usually does. But yeah, sometimes it's a bit of fun to have lucid dreaming. You can't really, you can control it up to a point, but not that much. And it's a bit of a waste of time. So it's much better that if you are aware enough to control your dreams, you should wake up and just meditate instead. So it's not an alternative. So, and it's a bit sort of, what you might call it, fantasy world, creative world. It's not reality, so it's not encouraged. Is it same between no self and non-self in Buddhism? No, just the way the Buddha used words, he wasn't a philosopher, he wasn't sort of a lawyer. So, you know, he used words in the local, in the way it was used by local people. So sometimes he said, that which is called mind or heart or consciousness, now that thing which is called different things by different people. So he used words loosely, like people use words loosely. So sometimes you say no self, sometimes you say non-self, exactly the same. Sometimes you say heart, sometimes you say mind, same thing. So the Buddha was using words. Abhidharma was different. But the Buddha used words in the local language, the way that ordinary people would use these words, not like a lawyer. Dear Ajahn Brahm, if I don't use a little bit of willpower to keep the mind still, it wanders around like a mad monkey mind. What's wrong with monkeys? Now, we are, many of you have evolved from monkeys. So maybe you really have got a monkey mind because in your previous life. So straight away we stigmatize poor monkeys. Shall I continue this like this or let the mind wander around? Please explain. Thank you. There's other ways of dealing with a wandering mind. Willpower, you'll find, will not work. You can hold it still for a little while, but you get tired and frustrated, and then it will start wandering around even more. So if your mind is wandering around, one of the reasons is you're really getting involved in the wandering mind. You know, you are actually making it wander more. You're not letting it go. One way of doing, of using wisdom power rather than willpower, just imagine your mind out here somewhere, and you, the observer, is separated, you know, from the screen on which all these fantasies or thoughts or plans are being made out, just like when you're watching a TV. If you're watching a TV and you remember you're sitting on a seat, the TV is over there, it's very easy not to get involved. You can turn it off if you want. You can laugh at it. But once you get involved, it is like you get sucked into the screen, like you're part of the action. And to make the point very clear, I often say, when you're watching a movie, why do you get afraid? Why do you get emotionally entangled and start crying? Oh, it's so sad. It's because you've got sucked in, you know, to the whole action. And don't just think this just happens to women. There's men when they're watching soccer matches or cricket, hit the ball, and they shout at the TV screen, and it's a match which is, you know, probably already finished in Sri Lanka, you know, last week,
and lost.
And well, whatever, lost or whatever, but you can shout in Perth and they can't hear you in Colombo, even if it is live. It's usually still sort of replay. So, why do people shout? I remember going to the movies and, you know, the old, this is 40, 45 years ago, just the old horror movies. And some big monster like tarantula was creeping up behind somebody. And somebody in the audience say, look out behind you. That'd be crazy because they can't hear you. You know, that was shot a couple of years ago in Hollywood and you're watching this in London. But why do we do that? Because, you know, we get sucked into the action. And that's exactly what happens when you have a fantasy or your mind starts to wander. You get sucked in there. if you could only just draw yourself back, you realize the cricket match, they can't hear you. So you don't get involved, you don't shout. You know, you don't cry when the heroine gets killed just before the ending. And I always like to talk about West Side Story, where Tony gets shot under the lamppost. Because I went there with my girlfriend, my friends and their girlfriends too. And when that happened in West Side Story, and Tony got shot under the lamppost in sort of the west side of New York City a long time ago. And Maria ran to him and held the love of her life as he was dying in her arms. And I don't know how this happened, but in the streets of New York late at night, there was an orchestra and they started playing, "There's a place for us. Somewhere a place for us." And all the girls, they were crying their eyes out. "What are you crying for? She'll get reincarnated in another half an hour when the movie starts again." "It's only a movie, come on." But if you get caught up in it, and you want to get caught up in it, that is why the mind wanders. You get caught up and you want to get caught up in it. And if you can somehow detach, look at the wandering mind out here somewhere, and imagine you're an observer at a distance, watching it. And it's very easy to let it go. Number one, you get perspective. It's rubbish thoughts. How many of you have meditated and hours have gone past and, "God, that was rubbish thoughts"? Why can you see it at the time? Because you're really involved in it. So imagine, just move yourself back a bit from the wandering mind. And when you can see it from a distance, it's very easy. It just stops automatically because you realize it's rubbish. Now that's using wisdom power, not willpower. And that actually works. How can I say if I'm sleeping or in a deep meditation? Do you know or feel the difference when you have been in deep meditation? One of the things you notice afterwards is you've got energy afterwards. If you've been asleep during a meditation, just like an ordinary sleep, you feel a bit dull when you first come out. Just like in the early morning. Some of you, you know, maybe you're my age, you get out of bed and you're not really alive until you've had your first cup of tea or coffee. You know, you're dull. And that's like when you come out of a sleep. You know, you've been meditating, been asleep, you feel dull. But if it's been a nice meditation, you feel a lot of energy and really happy. That's one of the main differences. In the Metta Sutta, being upright, perfectly upright, is explained as mental behavioral quality. But you explain it as being physically upright, not sleeping. Kindly explain. What do we say there? Being able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech. It means actually in the Metta Sutta, as I understood it, like upright of character. Doesn't always, like, you know, just mean sort of not laying down, not sleeping. But, you know, the whole metaphor of being a good person. And that's why upright. And, but you've got to be careful because sometimes many people misunderstand the words of the Metta Sutta. Now, upright, you know, just means morally upright. In just the same way that some years ago that somebody, you know, asked me, "Why is it, we've got two nuns over here, why is it that nuns always have a hard time, you know, getting monasteries or getting allowed to ordain?" And it's the Metta Sutta is the reason why. Listen to it. It said, "Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, whatever living beings they may be, omitting nuns, the grave." Someone pointed that out about a year ago. And so, just to make it gender neutral, we started chanting the Metta Sutta. "Whatever living beings they may be, omitting monks, let monks who anger will wish harm upon another." No, because sometimes, you know, it doesn't mean nuns, it means N-O-N-E. So anyway, last question. "Please could you explain walking meditation? I first thought it was because sitting still too long isn't good for you, but I see that the walking meditation is often very, very slow. How should we do it and why is it done?" Okay, so again, it is a pause between sitting meditation because you cannot sit for too long without sort of the body getting very sore, usually. Some people can sit long periods of time. So we do walking meditation. It's very similar to learn how to keep our mind reasonably still. So when we're doing walking meditation, we start at one end of the path and present moment awareness. So we're not really worrying where we're going to because there's nowhere to get to. No past, no future, being this moment. And then learn how to be silent, because it's pretty boring doing walking meditation. There's nothing really to look at. It's a very simple exercise. You don't need to sort of make too many decisions on how you're going to walk. So it's a very quiet, silent, present moment exercise. And what you tend to do, if you don't do this by choice, it happens usually naturally, you start to become aware of your feet as they're moving. You find out, for example, what part of the foot leaves the ground first. What leaves the ground last? And does the foot go vertically up, or does it go backwards a bit or forwards a bit? How does your foot move? In one step, just what are all the different movements? And what part touches the floor first? What last? How does the weight sort of balance on that foot? So you become really aware of just one step. And it's amazing. That gets you really interested, because it's a very simple thing to be focusing on. You're not thinking, you're not dreaming, you're aware of your body. You soon get very mindful, very still, and very happy. And you can carry on like that for a long time, and it's almost as good, if not better, than doing the walking meditation. Because you're getting still, you're focused, in this present moment, and getting a lot of happiness up. So it's not just a second-class meditation, it's a great meditation in and of itself. And the reason why people go slow sometimes is because there's too much going on. You can't go fast. But don't walk slow on purpose. Because it was only about 6 months ago, I think it was, that there was a retreat on here. And, you know, we always get some people, you know, wanting to have a look at our retreat center. And so they came with their son just to have a look. And when they went back to Bodhinyana Monastery for the lunch, the son came up to me and said, "Ajahn Brahm, Ajahn Brahm, are you at a retreat center? There are zombies at the retreat. I saw the zombies." Walking really slowly. So now I call the slow walking meditation, we call it zombie meditation. Because apparently the zombies are in the movies now. And zombies, apparently they always walk really slowly. Is that true? Because I don't know somebody. I always say that. So if they see anybody walking slow, you don't really know whether it's a meditator or a zombie. So you don't have to walk slow. Keep it natural. If it happens naturally, wonderful. If you want to walk fast, wonderful. So I know it. Sometimes it's happened in the walking meditation hall because you're walking next to one another. Sometimes there's a competition of who can walk slowest. That's crazy. So don't do that. So anyway, thank you for those questions for this evening. And again, any other questions you have, please write them down. You know, gone over maybe 15 minutes. Usually there's more questions come in the next few days. It's amazing. I always thought that as you get more and more quiet and